accession number 27083, reel 52.
Sir Henry, thank you very much indeed for continuing with your contribution to the Sound Archive, which is much appreciated, this tremendous contribution you're making. I think that where we left it, you had just received the news that you were going to be appointed CNC Fleet. Perhaps you could take me on from there, please.
Right. Well, this was an enormous joy and relief to me because, as I think I said earlier on, nobody had ever really moved on significantly. They had moved, but they weren't going to go to the top. Yeah. From the Vice Chief of the Defense Staff, different from the Vice Chief of a single service. So that was great relief. I was in with a chance again. And, of course, it was the finest job open to me at that time. Perhaps I'd better start by defining roughly what the job was. It was reasonably complex in that I had two national hats and two NATO hats. The national hats were, as the name implies, Commander-in-Chief Fleet, and that meant that I was responsible, ultimately, for all seagoing ships and what they did and so on. And the second national hat was to be in command of the national strategic deterrent, the Polaris Force, as it then was. And that meant that you were during certain times, if a crisis blew up, you had to stand by at your headquarters, which were at Northwood. They were at Northwood as a compromise between the importance of having, as far as possible, the fleet staff concentrated in one place, which it didn't succeed in doing entirely, on the one hand, and being as adjacent as possible, ideally they would have been in the same headquarters, as certainly the maritime element of the Royal Air Force. In fact, the operational equivalent in the Royal Air Force was at High Wycombe, and they had their setup there, and a very fine setup it was, and they didn't want to move. And I shall return to that later on. On the NATO side, I was a major NATO commander, as it was then called, MNC, of which there were three. Sac Lance, Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, and Sac Eure, Supreme Allied Commander Europe, both of whom were American. And Allied CNC Channel, which was me, the only non-American major NATO commander. With, and I'll say it now, a very much smaller area of responsibility and not really regarded as a full member of the triumvirate by the Americans. It was an American run thing and they liked it that way. Also on the NATO side, I was CNC Eastern Atlantic Area, which was an MSC, a major subordinate commander, again of NATO, subordinate to Sac Lant. I shall return to these things later. But as a result, of course, in my early days, after I had taken over, it involved a large number of calls to get to know my own national subordinate commanders, of which there were several, and I won't go into a catalogue of them. And in a way, more important and certainly more time-consuming, a quantity of NATO contacts, Zach Lant and Zach Yer himself, the Secretary General of NATO, the Chiefs of Defence of the various European member, NATO member countries. And this was very time-consuming because you couldn't really do any of these visits in much under 48 hours, which might or might not include travelling time. And observing that the object of the calls was to get to know your colleagues, it was a thing that you couldn't just nip in and nip out after a quick lunch and hope that you'd done your stuff, because you had to establish a relationship. And that took certainly nearer to 48 hours than to just a quick in and out, and so forth. So I was pretty busy to start with. My national and NATO headquarters were combined at Northwood, and many of my national staff also had a NATO hat.
So there was an element of coordination among the staff at Northwood. In other words, did you have staff that acted in a coordinating capacity with your NATO counterparts, or did everybody muck in at Northwood together?
It was nearer the latter, I think, because I had an international staff there. I had Dutch, I had French, I had, well, and so on. I had, for example, two chiefs of staff. One was national at vice admiral's level, and he was solely national. And in my absence, he de facto became the fleet commander. And the other was NATO, who was a Dutch rear admiral, splendid man too, they both were. But he was entirely confined to matters NATO. At a lower level on the staff, many of the weaponeers and so on at captain or commander's level, weaponeers, logisticians, communications, and so forth, were national staff officers, but they also carried a NATO hat, so they were duplicated. And this produced a very significant saving in bodies, and they could cope, and they did very well, and I had a very good team. I don't want to go on about Northwood too much. It was then, in structural terms, much the same as it is now. It had a large above-ground building, which was predominantly used by the by the national staff or the staff wearing their national hats. And then deep underground, supposedly bomb-proof and all that, was the tunnel, and that was where the NATO staff had their being. And therefore, when I was at Northwood, I would split my day, and I would normally go to the tunnel first and pick up all the NATO stuff, and then after lunch I would return to the national headquarters and deal with the national stuff, that sort of thing. So everybody knew where they stood and where to find me. Well, I say they knew where to find me, but a great deal of the time, especially in those early days, of course, I wasn't there at all. And I planned my program, because one had to waste no time about getting to know one's NATO opposite numbers. This is very important. And I planned my program, personal program, so that I would normally spend Monday and Friday at Northwood, and in between I'd be out and about seeing other people, which might be national flag officers and as well.
Now, I know you're not going to give me quite likely a complete catalogue of where you visited and who you visited and everything else, but you did touch on earlier this need to make a personal contact and establish a personal relationship with, for example, your opposite number NATO commanders. Could you just talk me through one such visit, perhaps the best example of you establishing what you had to do to establish a relationship with whoever it was? Just one example. You don't need to give it now, but if in the course of your talks, Henry, if you could do that at some point.
Yes. I'm trying to... I've set out my prep more or less in chronological order. So I'll come back to that
yes.
A little bit more than just one example, because I will give you a very brief and perhaps a reprehensible character analysis of some of the people I had to deal with. But whereas I took over, I suppose it was April or May, anyway, the spring of 77, and the fleet review to celebrate the Queen's
silver,
I suppose, yes, would have been Jubilee, was to take place at Spithead in June 77. And I'll clear the decks by dealing with that first. It was a major organization. Much of the groundwork had been done before I arrived. And so it only required for me to put the finishing touches and attend and actually supervise the assembly of the ships on an international basis and so forth off Spithead, which led to one or two interesting incidents which I will recount in due course. I flew my flag in Ark Royal. This is the old Ark Royal, the one that had had the controversial refit, and it was one of her last appearances. And that was fine. And very unfortunately, the weather was dreadful. It had to happen that way, I suppose, and it was tricky. It was cold, often it was wet, it was blowing half a gale. It was really very unpleasant indeed. Quite early on, I suppose I spent 3 or 4 days in Ark Royal immediately prior to and during the actual fleet review. And quite early on, I was rung up by, I think he was the Admiral Superintendent in Portsmouth, who said that there was a very senior Turkish admiral who was waiting on the jetty for a boat to take him out to his flagship, but his flagship didn't seem to have arrived. So, and this indeed was true, I checked. And there was only one thing for it, and that was to scoop him up and have him on board Ark Royal. So this was duly done. And I turned over my nice large cabin aft to him, and I spent that night in my sea cabin. He was a delightful man, I can't recall his name, awfully nice man. And next morning, it occurred to me that a way of entertaining him, so to speak, and keeping him out of everybody else's hair, was to have him up on the flight deck for the normal daily morning ceremony of colours. Well, it was the practice for... I normally went up if I was on board, but then I wasn't very often. It was the practice the captain attended. There was a small Royal Marines Guard. There was the colour party, of course. And after the ceremony was over, the colour party, the guard rather, marched off. And they gave the captain of the ship an eye's right or an eye's left as they passed him. And that was that. The whole thing was over in 10 minutes, rather less. And I let it be known to the Turkish admiral that this wasn't the normal routine, and therefore the guard paraded was in his honour. And on completion of the ceremony of colours, if he stood back, the guard would march past him and give him an eye's right, and this was for him. He never twigged that, I don't think. And it worked a treat, because we didn't have to vary the ship's routine, and that was fine. Well then, about the middle of the morning, his flagship, which was a rather clapped-out ex-American destroyer, arrived. And fortunately, maneuvered herself into more or less the right position in the line. And there were a lot of ships there, of course.
How many were there?
Oh, you caught me now. I'm guessing over 100, anyway. And all nationalities, of course, including some merchant ships, and so on. And towards midday, I got a signal from the Turkish admiral. Would I return his call and honour him by visiting his flagship? Which I did, and of course it wasn't a very large ex-American destroyer, and her upper deck was pretty cluttered, and they paraded a guard. And by the luck of the Lord, I remembered from my Vice Chief of Defense days the procedure for dealing with exclusively a Turkish guard. And the drill was that you started, it was normally drawn up in a single rank, and you started at the at one end, and before you started to go down the line, you said, Merhaba Asker, which crudely put meant, how is it with you? And you then walked down, because of course they didn't speak a word of English, nor I of Turkish. But this, it was a very good arrangement, because it meant that you were seen to be trying to establish communication and so forth. And this came back to me in the nick of time. So I trotted this out. And the next move was, when you got to the middle of the guard, you stood back, whether there was a colour or not. And each time you said your piece, all the men in the guard would give a sort of growl. They'd say, so, I think it was what they said, which meant it's all right, broadly. And you repeated this in the middle, and you said, Narsildinich, which meant, are you sure it's all right? And they would say, and then you moved on. And I remembered this drill, and they were frightfully impressed. So that was that, that drill for the admiral. I've mentioned the weather already, and it really was foul. And the next hurdle I had to take was receiving calls, because I was the senior officer afloat, and all these foreign, all these other countries fielded a ship or more, and their commanding officers, or their admirals if they had one, came on board to call on me. And I can't remember how many there were, but there were something like a dozen. And I established with my flag lieutenant, I'll return to him later, I established a standard drill, and you had to have this meticulously planned in order to fit them all in. And as far as the callers were concerned, they were allocated a 20-minute slot. And the form was for them to arrive at the starboard gangway, which was the senior ceremonial one. They'd be piped on board. There would be a guard drawn up on the quarterdeck. They would inspect the front rank of their guard. I would then lead them below, sit them down in my big day cabin, and give them a glass of brandy, good brandy too. But I couldn't compete with, you know, a dozen brandies in a forenoon sort of thing. And so I briefed my Perelster steward, and I made quite sure that I had seen what it was he was producing, to produce some cold tea to identically the colour of the brandy in a balloon glass as if it was brandy. And I then chatted in a welcoming fashion to my visitor. And after 15 minutes, not after 20, after 15 minutes, the flag lieutenant came in with a loud knock on the door and said, the next caller is approaching in his barge, sir, which wasn't true because it was 5 minutes ahead of time. That made my guest swallow what was left of his drink pretty rapidly, and I stood him up, walked him over to my visitor's book, got him to sign that, took him up on the quarterdeck, and as we went I said, no need to inspect your guard, it'll still be there, but you've inspected it already, and that's that. And then we piped him over the side and away. And it worked like a dream until it came to a Portuguese captain. They produced a frigate, and they came alongside in a sort of American motor whaler thing. I say they came alongside, they didn't. They missed the gangway. And round they went again. And they made, I don't know, two or three attempts to get alongside. And we were flinging heaving lines down and all the rest of it. And eventually they made it. And the poor man was rather shaken by this because it's perfectly clear. And there was a considerable array of people as a reception committee on the quarterdeck of this
watching
enormous
this
ship, watching his poor performance. Not that he was coxing the boat or anything, but so they didn't get it right. And the weather wasn't easy. And he arrived on board rather white and shaking, and of course we were fresh out of time, and so I had just tipped off the guard commander that he was to present arms, but there would be no inspection and we'd save a few minutes. And I thought the quicker this chap had a glass of brandy down in his stomach, the better. And that was that. But we ran slightly over time with him, and that was typical of the sort of thing that went on. It was very entertaining in retrospect. It was a bit nerve-wracking at the time because they were representing their country, and they had to be properly treated, and they had to feel that they were properly treated, and, you know, feel that they were able to puff a chest and so forth. Well, then, the day came, which I suppose would have been the day before, when I was going to do what amounted to a dress rehearsal of the actual event of the Queen embarked in the Royal Yacht, Britannia, steaming down the lines. And the form was that as Britannia passed each ship, everybody had manned ship overall. They were lining the guardrails and so on. And as the Royal Yacht came more or less abreast them. They all gave three cheers. That was the plan. And that included, of course, the merchant ships at the far end of the line. And then the yacht turned round and came back down a different line, and so on. And I did the rehearsal on board the training carrier, the Engadine. And off we went. And the first ship we passed was the American ship, an American nuclear-powered cruiser, the California. And she had a rear admiral, delightful man, about 6 foot six, tall, called John Dixon. And as we passed, they had manned the side. She was gleaming, very smart. And they had manned the side at considerable intervals. They'd put on their best uniforms. But we passed in dead silence, no cheering at all. And I thought, this is not a very happy entree. And then it occurred to me that maybe in the United States Navy, they didn't cheer ship. They didn't have a drill for that. So I made a mental note to check this out. Well, the rest of it happened more or less all right until we got to the end of the line when we got to the merchant ships. Not very many of them, three or four sort of thing. And the lead merchant ship was a shell training tanker. I say training because she had, as the majority of her ship's company, with one or two old sweats as supervisors, she had cadets. Again, they turned out, the ship was looking painted up and very smart, and everybody was in their best uniform, and they cheered, and that was fine, very smart. The next in line was a huge BP tanker, and she was quite the reverse. They hadn't painted ship, she wasn't at all smart. There was a rope's end trailing over the side. There were rust streaks everywhere. They hadn't manned ship at all. And there were a couple of guys in trousers and a singlet, sort of pottering about or leaning on the guardrails and wondering what the hell all this was about. It was awful. Well, that was that.
What did you do about that?
I'm just coming to it.
I'm sorry.
I finished the rehearsal and went back on board. And the first thing I did was to write a personal note to Rear Admiral John Dixon, United States Navy, in the California, in which I said that I didn't know whether it was never the practice for the U.S. Navy to chair ship, but I thought he would wish to know that this would be entirely acceptable, but I must warn the Queen in advance, because otherwise she would think it strange that this very fine, smart-looking ship was the only one that didn't show her. And I left it to him. And I got a return there saying that they would show ship. And that was that. As to the BP tanker, and the name of the BP tanker was British Respect, which was a bit anomalous to say the least. And I made them a signal and simply said that when Her Majesty passed in the Royal Yacht Britannia the following day, I hoped that they would man ship and give Her Majesty three cheers, like everybody else. End of message. And I was—I had no jurisdiction over the merchant ships, other than for their anchor birds. And that was my responsibility, to see that they got the right place, and so forth. But I couldn't give them a direct order, because they weren't under my command, and so on. I'll finish that bit off. Somehow this, and it was an unclassified signal too, somehow this was obtained by the media. And I think it was, can't remember, either the Daily Mail or the Daily Express, I think, printed a little 2-inch paragraph saying something about chairship by order. And it recounted, almost verbatim, so somebody must have slipped a copy, of what I'd said to the BP tanker. And when it was all over, I got a stinging letter from the chairman of BP, who said, who did I think I was, and what did I think I was up to on this occasion? And he didn't suppose that I realized that, unlike the lavish manning of Navy ships, his tankers had to run on a strictly economic basis, and they didn't have the men to man ship and so forth, which was a load of crap, frankly. And I wrote back and said exactly what had happened and exactly how I had found his ship, and how she was lying. The next ship in line was the rival Chow Mein.